morning and welcome to Under the Olive Tree. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Today is February the 2nd, 2006. The hour is 11 and we will be with you till noon as usual. Under the Olive Tree is the Palestinian Canadian community radio show. We have two reasons for our existence. The first, to provide the space, the equipment, and the know-how of radio production to Palestinian youth in order for them to reach our second goal, to produce content that truly represents the Palestinian community. I'm your host for the week, Laith Maarouf. If you want to join our production team or have any questions, please email us at our email, uot@ckut.ca. Those are the initials of Under the Olive Tree, uot@ckut.ca, or give us a call at our landline, area code 514-398-6788. That's the news department at CKUT. Again, 398-6788 with area code 514. In today's show, we listen to Ali Abu Naame, co-founder of the website Electronic Intifada, that is one of the main sources of Palestinian news on the internet. Ali came to Montreal in a tour organized by Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights in Southern Ontario and Quebec, and gave a lecture last Friday in Montreal in McGill University at the First People's House. The lecture was held by CKUT Radio McGill in coordination with SPHR and was titled Tea with Ali. It was more of a discussion, a town meeting, than a lecture, because Ali spoke for a small, brief period with a nice crowd that asked many questions and took the discussion further. Later that night, Ali gave his full lecture in UQAM University in French. So today we listen to this discussion with Ali Abu Naame around the issues of Palestine, the elections, occupation, the media, and solidarity building. The lecture was recorded by David Tassiam from CKUT's News Collective. We thank him for this contribution. We also have a great lineup of music. Our first song that we're going to listen to right now is called Ana Mushkafir, I Am Not a Heretic, and it is a song by Ziad Rahbani, the son of Feruz and the great Rahbani composer. The lyrics are amazing. He says, I am not a heretic, but hunger is a heretic. I'm not a heretic, but poverty is a heretic. Well, what can I tell you if all the heretic things are in me? We listen to this beautiful tune.
أنا مش كافر بس الجوع كافر أنا مش كافر بس المرض كافر أنا مش كافر بس الفقر كافر والذل كافر أنا مش كافر لكن شو بعملي إذا اجتمعوا فيي كل اللي شير كافري أنا مش كافر بس الجوع أنا مش كافر
بس المرض كافر
أنا مش كافر
بس الفقر كافر
والذل كافر
أنا مش كافر لكن شو بعملي إذا اجتمعوا فيي كل الأشياء الكافرين
ياللي بيصلي الأحد وياللي بيصلي الجمعة ياللي بيصلي الأحد ويلي بيصلي الجمعة وقاعد يفلح فينا على طول الجمعة
يلي بيصلي الأحد ويلي بيصلي الجمعة يلي
بيصلي الأحد
يلي بيصلي الجمعة
وقاعد
يفلح فينا على طول الجمعة
يلي
بيصلي الجمعة ياللي بيصلي الأحد ياللي بيصلي الجمعة وقاعد يفلح فينا على طول الجمعة هو ياللي دين قال وأنا ياللي كافر عال هو ياللي دين
راجعوا كلام القادر أنا مش كافر بس جوعك
مش كافر بس المرض كافر
أيوة
أنا مش كافر بس الفقر كافر والذل كافر أنا
مش كافر بس البلد كافر انا مقبور ببيتي ومش قادر هاجر وعم تاكل اللقمة بتمي واكلك قدامك يا عمي
وعم تاكل اللقمة بتمي واكلك قدامك يا عمي
واذا بكفر
بتقلي كافر
عمام عالدول الغربية ومبلغ كل المخافر أنا مش كافر
أنا مش كافر
عيدة أنت الكافر
أيوة
أنا مش كافر
كافر
مدام أنت الكافر
أيوة
أنا مش كافر
أنا مش كافر
قلنا مين الكافر
كافر
وعرفوا مين الكافر
كافر
أنا مش كافر مثل ما عم قلك
عم بتحط في كونك شيخ الكافرين
آمين.
You are listening to a discussion with Ali Abinuma. Ali Abinuma is a co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. This discussion was held at the First People's House on 3505 Peel on January the 29th, 2006.
What we want is to provide additional and alternative places for people to publish, to discuss, to get news, and at the same time to provide critical analysis of what happens in the rest of the media. So we don't want to be a place where people go to refuge, to find a refuge from the mainstream media necessarily, but a place that provides tools that they can challenge the rest of what's out there and read it and listen to it critically. And I think the Palestinian elections this week provide a really good example of the way a clearly important event is discussed kind of in the mainstream on the CBC and in large corporate media, which I've been talking to all week. You know, when they call and when they ask questions, what the questions are and what the assumptions are behind them tell quite a story about how this thing is viewed. And of course, it's very predictable the way the story is told, that Hamas, a terrorist group, won the elections, and so the spotlight is on them. Are they going to remain quote-unquote terrorists, or are they going to be nice and act responsibly and moderate and so on? And respectable opinion requires one to say these things or to ask these questions, and very rarely are the deeper questions asked as to where this movement comes from and what it is actually saying. One of the things that has really struck me is how all of a sudden, and it's not clear where this came from, people talk about a Palestinian government and the formation of a government, which is very interesting because when the Oslo Accords were signed and the Palestinian Authority was created with Israeli permission, Israel was extremely careful to ensure that there were no terminology was used in the agreements or afterwards that suggested the existence of a Palestinian state or a government. So the reason the Palestinian Authority was called the Palestinian Authority and not the Palestinian government was because Israel didn't want to suggest that there was a sovereign entity. Another example was that at that time Yasser Arafat headed the Palestinian Authority. Israel insisted that the word president couldn't be used in the Oslo Accords. And so his official title was chairman of the Palestinian Authority. And they said you can use the word Ra'is in Arabic, which means can mean president, but it also just means sort of a generic term for the leader or the head of something. So Israel was prepared to allow that term in Arabic because it had enough ambiguity that they could say, no, he's not a president. And somewhere down the line, the media and commentators and politicians started referring to the chairman of the Palestinian Authority as the president and the Palestinian Authority as the Palestinian government. And as far as I'm aware, there has been no alteration in the Oslo Accords or in any of the agreements, and there's no sort of legal or institutional basis for which to start referring to a Palestinian government. And so this raises a question for me is, what's the intent behind this? Why wasn't it acceptable to say Palestinian government a few years ago? And why now has everyone sort of slipped into it unthinkingly? And, you know, to me, or sort of what you learn in political science class, is that a government exists in a place where it has control and sovereignty over a specific territory, and that a government's first responsibility is to protect the security, the lives, the property of the people it governs. And so the question then is, does the Palestinian Authority meet those criteria? Does it control territory? Can it protect the people it supposedly rules? And the answer to that, for anyone who has looked at the situation on the ground in Palestine, is clearly no. That since the Palestinian Authority was created, it has had no capability to protect Palestinian lives and property. We've never seen, for example, or there were a few exceptional occasions when Palestinian Authority security services tried to stand between Palestinian civilians and the Israeli army, and there was an international outcry. They said, you can't do that. We didn't allow you to have guns to defend Palestinians against Israel. We gave you guns so you can defend Israel against Palestinians. And so it doesn't meet the basic criteria of a government in that sense. Can it defend people's property? We see that the number of Israeli settlers in the occupied territories has doubled since the Palestinian Authority was created. The number of Palestinian trees uprooted in the occupied territories in the past 10 years exceeds 1 million. And so we see that the Palestinian Authority cannot protect the environment, the water, the homes, the land of Palestinians. So whose interest does it serve to start referring to this entity as a government? And why begin to do so? And here it's clear that the need to have the fiction of a Palestinian government is dictated by Israel's panic about demography. This is an issue that is rarely addressed in mainstream media discussion of the issue of Palestine. The simple fact that in the totality of Israel-Palestine, Jews are a minority. The state of Israel exercises military, economic, physical control over Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip. And in the totality of that territory, Jews are a minority. They're about 49% of the population, and they are decreasing rapidly. So this places Israel in a situation where it must either recognize that reality and share power with the disenfranchised majority, which is obviously very distasteful for Israel, because it means giving up power, it means giving up economic control, it means giving up military control, or you need to have some way to get around this. And the way to do that is to create the fiction of a Palestinian government, to say that the rights of Palestinians will not be achieved by giving them a say in the true government of the country, which is the government of Israel, which really decides what Palestinians can and can't do, whether they live and die, whether they drink water or not, whether their trees are left standing or not, whether they're able to go to school or not, whether they're able to travel or not. All these decisions are taken by the government of Israel, not by the Palestinian Authority. And in order to disguise that, they're now talking about a Palestinian government. And this is a situation which is exactly parallel to the one that existed in apartheid South Africa, where for many, many years, the white government of South Africa said, well, you know, we understand, we're Democrats, we don't want to rule over anyone, so if Africans want their rights, we will create little states for them and they can go and vote there. And everybody saw through that. Everybody understood that that was a fiction designed to circumvent and forestall the demand for justice. And what's amazing is the shallowness of the discussion in, you know, on the CBC or on CNN or on the BBC when it comes to these issues. That everyone has simply accepted the notion that there's a Palestinian government and, oh, what will Hamas do? As if, even if Hamas takes control of the Palestinian Authority, it will have the ability to govern, to take decisions and implement them on behalf of the people it represents. So this is a clear example of the way language is used in the media to change our perception of what reality is and to disguise a reality which is absolutely apparent to Palestinians living under this situation and to others who are, you know, take the time to look at it closely. And it's, of course, for these kinds of reasons that we felt the need to create the Electronic Intifada, which we created myself and three other co-founders, Nigel Parry, Laurie King-Irani, and Ariane El-Fasid, just almost exactly 5 years ago. And what we try to do, it's a website that's in English, so clearly our audience is not people in Palestine and not people in the Arab world, because we feel that people there have access to this kind of information. It's not really our mission to try to represent that reality to them, but to try to reach a North American audience, perhaps a European audience, a global audience. The reality is that the vast majority of our readers are in the United States and Canada, and to a lesser extent in Europe, and then we have readers in, we have, you know, we do get mail from India and New Zealand and other places, but the reality is we're talking to a North American audience, and that presents the challenge of always having to deal with the overwhelming flow of information from the mainstream media, which at the same time we are somewhat in opposition to, but also have to try to use as much as we can. And, you know, putting up the website means that we get calls from journalists, calls from TV stations and radio stations who are going to allow us a minimal space, sometimes, you know, as much as 5 minutes and sometimes as little as 8 seconds to try to get our point across. So that's, I think, all I want to say for now, just in order to kind of launch the discussion and give you some context as to the way we're never quite taking things at face value, but always trying to challenge and question the assumptions in the way a story or a narrative is told. And the elections now are just an ideal example of the need to do that and the difficulty of doing it. The Palestinian Authority is a government, and that you have sort of a sovereign independent state, which is the assumption that lies behind that, which very much suits Israel. It suits Israel to portray the idea that it is not really in control, that this is somehow an independent state. You would say things like, oh, will the responsibility of government and incumbency moderate Hamas and cause them to become sort of more mainstream and so on and so forth? That's the kind of discussion you might engage in. If you take the position that the Palestinian Authority was created in order to protect Israeli interests rather than Palestinian interests, then and that Hamas, or the rise of Hamas, is the result of the Palestinians seeing that they're under occupation, seeing that negotiation hasn't led anywhere, that the number of settlements is growing, that they're less free and more poor than ever before, and that therefore they are supporting resistance, then you would say, not will the Palestinian Authority transform Hamas into a partner that the Canadian aid agency and the European Union are comfortable with, but will Hamas be able to convert the Palestinian Authority into an instrument of serving the interests of the Palestinians and resisting the occupation? It's usually the first interpretation that is the one that dominates. But I think that among many Palestinians, it's the second one that is more interesting, that they rejected the Palestinian Authority because they didn't see it serving their interests. And the challenge for Hamas is which direction they're going to go and whether and how they can do that. We shouldn't assume that they will be allowed to influence the situation.
We were just listening to Ali Abunama, co-founder of Electronic Intifada, speaking to a crowd in McGill University. We'll return to that discussion, but we will break for a song. It is beautiful vocal performance by Umayma, the Lebanese singer that sings with Marcel Khalifa. The song is to the suffering that happened in South Lebanon during the Israeli occupation there, and is called Land of the South, Ard al-Janoub. We listen to it.
عليك الجرح وانتصبي رمحا من اللهب يا ساحة الأنواء كم عصفت فيها خيول الهول والرعب شدي عليك الجرح وانتصبي عبر الدجى رمحا من اللهب شدي عليك الجرح وانتصبي عبر الدجى رمحا من اللهب يا ساحة الأنواء كم عصفت فيها خيول الهول والرعب فالأرض فيها وجه مذبحة والجو أمطار من الشهب لم يبقى غصن غير منتهب لم يبقى وجه غير مستلب فالأرض فيها وجه مذبحة والجو أمطار من الشهب لم يبقى غصن غير منتهب لم يبقى وجه غير مستلب صد الرياح السودا يحفظهم مع جرح ترابي وأنة العشب شغيلة من أرضي عاملة أكرم بهم من عاطر من صخرها قدوا عنتهم واسترشدوا بالكوكب الذهبي واسترشدوا بالكوكب واسترشدوا بالكوكب الذهب لم يغرهم تاج ومملكة لم يثنهم صعب عن الطلب لم يغرهم تاج ومملكة لم يثنهم صعب عن الطلب ما همهم إلا الربا سلمت آيات
The audience was quick to bring up parallels between the Palestinians and the Aboriginal peoples of Canada.
Well, there are many interesting parallels. I had no idea of the connection between the Canadian reservation system and the Bantustans in South Africa. However, I'm very aware that there is a strong connection between the Bantustans in South Africa and what Israel is doing, which dates back to the era of apartheid when South Africa and Israel had very, very close relationships, particularly in the military sphere. The Bantustans were carefully studied by Israel, and Israel was one of the few countries. They didn't officially recognize the Bantustans, but they participated in them deeply in helping to try to set up their educational systems and so on and so forth. And there were sort of delegations that went from apartheid South Africa, from the government, to Israel to study how, because the apartheid government was trying to control what they called the influx of blacks into the big cities. And so they actually went to the Israelis to study how the Israelis were preventing the influx of Palestinians into Jerusalem. That Israel, since 1967, had an explicit policy to prevent the Palestinian population in Jerusalem exceeding 28.8%. It was that specific, the Israeli goal. And so there were very, very close links. And when you talk about the role of Canada more broadly, I'd like to take, you know, sort of Canada and Canada's kind of the Scandinavia of North America. It plays a similar role in North America to Scandinavia in Europe, where there is this very progressive image and very sort of benign, you know, Canadians are lovely as people, but, you know, the government they're talking about. There's a very benign image that Canada could really do no harm in the world. Canada is out there because it wants everyone to get along. And the role of this kind of non-confrontational politics of countries like Canada and Scandinavia is really to enable the kinds of abuses that Israel is doing, because what they have become really is sort of simply they are subsidizing the occupation, and Palestinians have come to understand that very, very clearly. That to give an example, in May 2004, Israel demolished the homes of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Rafah. And nobody in the international community said anything or did anything. Israel was able to commit war crimes, that's what major human rights groups called them, in Rafah, making thousands of people homeless for the second, third, or fourth time, killing hundreds of them. Nobody said anything. Then afterwards, all the nice countries, the Canadas, the Japans, the Norways, came in to rebuild the homes. So what they're doing is simply subsidizing the occupation and enabling it. And so it's very interesting that the European Union, which is one of the biggest culprits in this complicity with the occupation, very prominently threatened Palestinian voters in the occupied territories. You know, if you vote for Hamas, we'll cut off the aid. And we see what kind of impact that had on Palestinians, who heard that very clearly. It was well reported in Palestine that you know, aid would be threatened. And they said, okay, you know, make our day. And a final point that you raise is the non-participation or the disenfranchisement of a large segment of native peoples from this system that has been set up. And there, Palestinians, there's really an exact parallel in that two-thirds of Palestinians are not entitled to participate in these elections at all because they are refugees and exiles. And again, here, coming to draw this back to the media and the way that this is covered in the media and who determines the agenda of the media. Take the example of the Iraqi elections, where in Chicago there was one of the North American polling stations for Iraqi voters. And so there was a lot of coverage in the Chicago media and the national media about, you know, Iraqis in America traveling to Chicago so they could vote in the Iraqi election. Palestinians had no such opportunity. But there was no one to ask why. And why the United States, why Canada, why the EU, why the Palestinian Authority had no interest in providing Palestinians in the diaspora with an opportunity to vote, and yet why it served their interest to allow Iraqis in their diaspora to vote, and why those questions don't get asked. So there are a lot of parallels.
And I'm interested in the idea of creating a web portal and what you think, like the possibilities for using the internet and using kind of the connections between different people in the movement and what happens in the global community when there's a different kind of vision of what's going on. and just how you see like the difference between what happened in South Africa when that kind of global network was not available and what kind of difference would be now. I don't know, just speaking to what was just said, I think education is the key, and also looking at trying to unite groups like Aboriginals and to create a united front, like what possibilities exist within that community? Like, well, what inspired you to solve this problem through a connection to the internet? Like, what did you envision? What do you envision?
The internet was really an incredible tool, particularly thinking back about a decade ago or more, which, you know, is like a century in internet terms almost. But it provided the first forum where Palestinians, who because of their condition were scattered everywhere, could really talk to each other. And for me, it was the first time I was able to really communicate easily with Palestinians in Palestine. And I had never been able to go to Palestine up to that point in my life, like the majority of Palestinians who don't have the simple opportunity to travel to their country. And that was a very important, and in fact, Nigel, one of the co-founders of Electronic Intifada, that's how I first met him. And we just started using the internet as a tool to try to mobilize people. And it did allow us to feel very, very much empowered in a way we hadn't before. And I think that the possibilities it offered, you know, it's still, you know, when I think about it, we're minuscule, you know. It's not like it really did change the world, but it at the same time, it provided us with an opportunity that we couldn't get any other way. We don't have the means to own a TV station or a national newspaper or anything like that. But, you know, on the web, you're kind of, you and CNN are the same size. And what matters there is kind of the quality and your ability to talk to people in a way that they respond to. So it's something we just experimented with. I remember one particular thing in September 1996, when Israel carried out a major assault on, it was after Israel had opened this so-called archaeological tunnel in East Jerusalem, which was sort of a political provocation. And there was that was one of the only times Palestinian Authority forces really fought back against Israel. And the stuff I was seeing coming out over the internet was unlike anything I'd ever seen before, and totally unlike what was being reported on radio and television and in the newspapers. Just, I remember seeing the images of classroom desks with the glass on them and with the shells, that's kind of 50 millimeter shells that Israeli helicopters had fired into Palestinian schools and houses and things. I'd never seen that before. And it just struck me right there and then that we had the ability to go around these mediators who decide what is and what isn't allowed to be shown. I think your point about Aboriginal or Indigenous peoples and the ability to sort of network and share experience, to me, is very important. I've always seen, and I think a lot of Palestinians have seen, very strong parallels with the experience of Native Americans and other indigenous peoples. But generally, Palestinians are not thought of as being in the same category. I'm not quite sure why that is. That's something I think we need to think about and talk about. But looking at the election in Bolivia, with an indigenous president taking over for the first time and talking about, you know, after 500 years of colonization, now 500 years of power, is so resonant with the Palestinian experience, and yet that connection is insufficiently made. And Israel has actually worked to try to co-opt this notion of being indigenous. And, you know, they've even brought tribal leaders from North America to Israel to say, oh, we indigenous peoples of the world, we Israeli colonists who came from Europe 60 years ago, a new native people of North America have so much in common. And so I think they've understood the power of that analogy or the power of that parallel and even tried to co-opt it. So I think it's one that's worth pushing and worth exploring. And we have the irony of the, I don't know how much coverage this has gotten in Canada, but Jack Abramoff, the super mega corrupt lobbyist who...
Facilitator.
Right, facilitator, exactly. There's the word. Who has just pleaded guilty to a number of crimes. And of course was very deeply involved with the top Republican congressional leadership, and who was really extorting money from... the things he was doing was... It's just incredible. Basically taking millions and millions of dollars from tribes in the United States to lobby. But, you know, it was... He'd do things like... He would give money to the Christian Coalition so they could mount campaigns against gambling to get Indian casinos shut down. And then he would go to the tribes and take millions of dollars from them so that he could lobby on their behalf to reopen the casinos that he had he had got shut down. I mean, it's just... It's a level of corruption and cynicism and vileness that is very hard to comprehend and grasp. One of the things he was doing was that he was taking money from tribes in the United States and siphoning it off and channeling it to Israeli settler groups in the West Bank. So he's actually... stealing from indigenous people in the United States in order to help the settlers basically screw over the Palestinians. And so, you know, there is again a very direct connection. And of course it got very, very little coverage. Had it been Palestinian Americans raising money in North America and sending it to Palestinian groups, the Attorney General himself would have read the indictments out at the press conference. But, it was barely a footnote, the hundreds of thousands that Abramoff was sending to arm the settlers. And it was interesting to listen to some of the Native American leaders saying, you know, we are horrified, we would never have... we're just horrified to know our money was being used in this way. But it is an important discussion to have.
That was Ali Abunama. We were still listening to the end of his discussion in McGill University held last Friday in the First People's House. The event was held by CKUT Radio and the First People's House as a part of the Social Justice Week in McGill University. Ali was in a tour held by Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights in South Ontario and Quebec. You can check their website at www.sphr.org, and you can check Ali's website, electronicintifada.org. I will leave you with one last song before we come back and say our goodbyes. And the song is again a performance by Ziad Rahbani, and it's called Shu Hal Ayyam, What Days. It's an economics justice song that speaks to the uneven distribution of wealth in the world.
هالايام اللي وصلنا له قال انه غني عم يعطي فقير كانه المصاري قشطت لحاله عايدة نتفي وايدة كتير حلوة دي حلوة دي حلوة دي تعجن في الفجر
شو هالايام اللي وصلنا قال انه غني عم يعطي فقير قال كانه المصاري اشرب انت حالك عايدة نتفي وايدة كتير حلوة دي حلوة دي حلوة دي تعجن في الفجرية
بيقولوا لك من عرق جبينه طلع مصاري هالإنسان طيب كيف هيدا وكيف ملايينه وما مرة شايفينه عرقان مش صحيح مش صحيح مش صحيح الهوى غلاه
شو هالايام اللي
وغلاه
قال انه غني عم يعطي فقير كانه المصاري
نشطت لحاله
عايدة نتفق وهيدا كتير حلوة دي حلوة دي حلوة دي
الغني من تلقاء نفسه حابب يوزع ورق المال منه بخيل ابدا على عكسه تذكركن يا ولاد الحلال
ليل يا لال ليل يا لال
كل واحد منا عنده سبيله ما بيمنع انه يصير تنسيق جيب لي لمضيلك قلم يسيله كل الشعوب بكرة حتفيق يا سلام
يا سلام يا أصلا من جياب الناس مسحوبة لازم ترجع عجياب الناس هي يا دي هي يا دي هي يا دي هي الأصلية هي يا دي
That was Ziad Rahbani bringing us to the end of our show with his song Shu Hal Ayyam, What Days, on economic justice. Thank you very much for listening to us. If you want to join our production team or have any questions, please email us at our email, uot@ckut.ca. Those are the initials of Under the Olive Tree, uot@ckut.ca, or give us a call at our landline, area code 514-398-6788. That's the news department at CKUT. Again, 398-6788 with area code 514. I'm your host, Laith Maruf, saying until we meet under the olive tree next week, I wish you a free, free Palestine.